Music from the court of the Qing Dynasty in 17th century China. China's been the lifelong preoccupation of Michael Wood, Professor of Public History at the University of Manchester, and an accomplished presenter of 120 documentaries, not just about China, and a popular six-part documentary series, The Story of China. And this is the book of the series, if you like, The Story of China, a portrait of a civilization and its people, but updated and with far more content and greater scope. It covers in detail the entire history of the Middle Kingdom over thousands of years. Professor Michael Wood, hello.
Hi, great to be with you.
Your professional life hasn't entirely been tied up with China, but a goodly portion of it has. Why?
Do you know, it's funny, isn't it? I was just thinking recently, because somebody pointed out to me rather unkindly that I've been making film documentaries for 40 years, just coming up. This is the 40th anniversary, you know, and they take me all over the world and, you know, story of India and stuff like that. But China always had a kind of special place in my heart. And it's true, the last 7 years, I've pretty much, you know, a dozen films in China. But I loved it from when I was a kid. It's one of those things you can never quite explain, is it? Why in a bookshop in Manchester, the teenage me picked up a book of Chinese poetry and opened it. And it was, I just went, wow. You know, it was as if it had opened to a door to a world that I never dreamed existed. And then I first went to China in the early 80s. So there's a long interest, really. So although the book is it's a big book and serious stuff in it, but in a way it's a labour of love.
It is a big book. Quoting you from it, in fact, quoting someone else who you quote, China is a huge and incredibly rich, inexhaustible subject, the other pole of the human mind. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great quote, isn't it? Now, this guy, Simon Leys, who actually was a sinologist in Australia, died recently, actually, a really, truly great, great figure. And what he meant by that, I think, was that all the other great civilizations that we encounter in the Western world, and of course, the view's different from New Zealand, you know, and from Australia, no question. Your position in the world gives you a different perspective. But for those of us brought up in the Western tradition and the European tradition and the Greeks and the Romans and, you know, Islam, even India, there's always a kind of familiarity to them. And it's only when you go to China, this is what Simon Leys meant by that phrase about the other pole of the human mind. It's only when you go to China and you see how differently they do things and they think. We tend to think, you know, it's been Europe and Britain and America tend to think that our way of doing things is the way to do things. And it's only when you encounter China that you find an otherness, which is so kind of complete. Even now, despite the fact in the last 40 years, China's gone headlong for growth and capitalism and all that. It's only then. I mean, I remember coming first, I'd not been to China for a while. And then in 2013, we went into this was in Shanghai, and we went into a Starbucks, you know, and there was John Coltrane playing on the loudspeaker, and you could order a kind of whatever, your caramel latte or whatever, you know, and you think, wow, and you look outside and there's 12-story high adverts for Christian Dior and all those sort of Western stuff, and you think it's gone that way, but actually the old China's still there in people's thought patterns, and they do things differently there, and there's a continuity going back 4,000 years.
And quoting you, as you ask in the book, what were the driving ideas of the civilization and what relation does today's China have to that past? If I've read this right, the foundation of the Chinese state, that idea, has been there since the very beginning. 2,000 odd years before Christ, with enormous repercussions for the 4,000 years that have followed?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question. I mean, China is the oldest continuous civilization in the world, and it's also the oldest continuous state. China is a united bureaucratic empire, if I can put it that way. It goes back to 221 BCE, so it's a couple of thousand years, you know. And over that huge period, there are certain things about governance and the state that kept coming back, you know, the idea of the great ruler who was like the sage monarch, as they call it in Chinese, you know, the bureaucratic system that sustained him, which was essentially autocratic. You know, unlike the Western world, they didn't develop a system where, you know, you had the rule of law. I mean, it's not that they didn't have law codes, but essentially the authority resided in the great leader. And that bureaucratic centralism, if you like, persisted all the way through. And in the 19th century, they tried to develop ideas following on Western models as to how to get rid of the empire, the tyranny of the empire, if you like, or to make it a more constitutional monarchy. And then, you know, they had a republic briefly, then the Japanese invasion and the civil war, and the communists came in 1949. And what stunned all the scholars of Chinese in the Western world was that the communists replicated, while saying that they wanted to get rid of what they call the feudal world that still persisted, they replicated the structures of bureaucratic tyranny that had been there in the empire, you know. But also, in the case of Chairman Mao, the utter devotion to the figure of the emperor, the great ruler, the sage king. You know, the sayings of Chairman Mao were printed in the little red book in hundreds of millions of copies as if they had come down like tablets from heaven, you know. And they never quite got rid of that. I mean, you could honestly look at China today and see the cult of President Xi Jinping, and the way that he's reviving the, you know, the respect for Mao, and, you know, Mao's being rehabilitated, and say that they still have this idea that there is a supreme leader who is supremely wise, and you give your allegiance to that order. It could have ended up like Europe with, 20 different countries, but it didn't. And one of the reasons it didn't is you've got this deep cultural sense that China is one country, one imperial order, if you like.
Getting inside that Chinese mind a bit more, there is still even now the influence in China, is there, of the old driving mantra to do with the will of heaven. That was always paramount. Yeah. And I wonder if in some sense it still is, even in this less godly age.
Yeah, you wonder, don't you? You know, this idea of the mandate of heaven, that, you know, China's history has many dynasties and dynasties collapse. There's a cycle and a new dynasty rises. And the new dynasty was deemed then by the scholars and the soothsayers and everybody to have received the mandate of heaven. And in very ancient times, that was literally a sign from heaven. You know, it was a conjunction of planets or astrological conjunctions that marked the beginning of the new era and its auspiciousness. You know, if you see the Communist Party as being the latest dynasty, if you like, after the interregnum post 1912 of the Republic and then the Japanese invasion, civil war, and the disorders which often happen between dynasties, then the Communist Party really looks like a new dynasty. You could say it's a metaphor, but they have the mandate of heaven, but how you keep the mandate of heaven is a really interesting question, because you have to be a good ruler, you have to protect the people, you have to guarantee kind of peace and order, and you have to have a moral order as well. You know, in the history of China, it's a moral civilization. Confucian, not a religious civilization in our sense. You know, they weren't controlled by theology, but they were controlled by the philosophy of the great Iron Age philosopher Confucius, and it was essentially moral order, and the rulers had to have that. And the question of whether they do have that, you know, they're very conscious of this. The anti-corruption campaign that Xi Jinping has launched since 2013 was in response to widespread understanding that the order had become massively corrupt since the opening up, you know, in the 80s and 90s and noughties. So I sometimes think these old ideas are helpful, but I would say that I'm a historian. You take the long view and you think, oh, that's interesting. Oh, God, look at that parallel. And, actually, Xi Jinping is very, himself is very conscious of the greatness of the Chinese past, pushing very hard the national narrative, the greatness of Chinese civilization, the Chinese way, The Chinese news programs at the moment on telly, they're watching what's happening in America. They're watching what's happening in Britain. They're watching Brexit. They're watching Trump. They're watching the unbelievable failures of democracy in some parts of the world, not in New Zealand, one may say.
No, true.
And they are saying, well, look, you are saying liberal democracy is a superior form of governance to our one-party state, but are you seriously telling us what's happening in America is something that we should be emulating? And Xi Jinping is pushing very much the idea that the Chinese way is the way, but of course it's a very loaded and biased interpretation of what the Chinese way is.
Yeah, of course. The Story of China, A Portrait of a Civilization and Its People, and Professor Michael Wood is with us. You say it is easy, of course, to use conformity to reinforce a repressive system, even though Confucius was adamantly against unjust rule, which should be opposed. And there is the rub for China today, isn't it? I mean, harmony, economic progress depends on this peculiar blending of individual prosperity, encouraging identity without the identity politics, and kind of knowing there are lines you just do not cross to achieve what you refer to as the great unity, Da Yi Tong. It's a pretty hard road to walk.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And it has been all the way through Chinese civilization. And some of the great rulers, like the first emperor, the famous emperor whose terracotta army has been excavated around his tomb in Xi'an, he was the ferocious punishments side of that. He didn't go for Confucian virtue, he went for ferocious punishments. Confucianism itself, so deeply ingrained in Chinese character. It does encourage conformity, and you could argue it's an enemy of creativity. And those battles between the hard line and the Confucian virtue, between order and creativity, exist in all civilizations, don't they? I mean, you guys are blessed in New Zealand to have a not only a wonderful land, but a small enough population for real ideals of civic virtue to be realistically work in society. It's very difficult when you're ruling 1.4 billion people. And in China, that feeling of better a year of tyranny than a day of anarchy, they fear that. There's a great story that when Deng Xiaoping went to America and he met Jimmy Carter, when they were opening up in 1979, there was some point where there was something difficult happening in American politics, and Carter made this remark to Deng Xiaoping about, God, American politics. And Deng Xiaoping said to him through his translator, he said, you're complaining. You should try ruling China. He said, if we had one man, one vote, he said, here, it would be anarchy. But that's not necessarily true. It depends what the vote does, and a consultative socialist state could be more democratic. And with a better working legal system, I think the real core for China is, are they prepared to have a proper workable legal system that runs right through, a rule of law
Yes. Well, that's. I know I'm talking a lot about the recent past or the present, and your book covers thousands and thousands of years. But Confucius, you say, was a failure in his own lifetime. He ran up against ill will and corruption and cliques who wouldn't listen to his, virtuous messages. Don't we see that same dichotomy today in a way? Because publicly, China preaches international harmony and cooperation, but underneath that is the soft colonization, the aggression in the South China Sea, the eyes on Taiwan?
No, it's really. I spoke to a really great sinologist I remember I went to a talk of his about 5 years ago, and I said to him, "Where do you think it's going to go?" You know, because everybody had been quite optimistic about Xi Jinping when he came in, and a lot of people liked him. You know, I think this guy Steve Simon said, "Well, actually, in the short term, I'm not very optimistic. I think they're going to be bad neighbors. At medium to long term, I'm pretty optimistic." But his prophecy has come true. When you look at what's been happening in Hong Kong, South China Sea, as you say, is under, you know, they have no conceivable claim to those lumps of rock between the Philippines and Vietnam. No conceivable claim. They just made up a story of some old map. You know, it's ridiculous. And when you look at what's happening in Tibet now, again, Xinjiang, the horrendous stuff with the Uyghurs, which is now being revealed, you know, they can't escape, you know, knowledge by the outside world. Inner Mongolia, the threats to Taiwan, there's a muscular nationalism coming out. And one Chinese diplomat a few days ago said, yes, China's perception is that America is losing. So that they're seizing their opportunity. And the awful thing is that the COVID-19, because of their state-centered organization and because of the discipline and collectivity of the people, they have recovered, are recovering, it seems, remarkably quickly from what happened.
Yeah.
Whereas we're watching the disintegration in America of many important areas of public life, aren't we? You know, so that this may be a moment where China's aggrandizement is going to continue. And they do use that language. You're absolutely right. Is it insecurity? Why do they need at this moment to do these things that they're doing, or the Hong Kong situation? You know, it's perplexing. There are a number of stories have come out about splits within the Communist Party leadership, about big criticisms within the leadership. There's been some eye-opening stuff coming out of people who are quite high up in the Communist Party and in the Communist Party Central School, personally attacking Xi Jinping, you know. So, I mean, the short answer to the futurology is probably that, you know, Xi Jinping and his contemporaries are all the sons of they're the princelings, you know, they're the sons of the generation who followed Mao and who were, you know, big in the 50s and 60s. And they're inculcated with that, you know, experience. Whereas the generation who were brought up after the reform and opening up, after 1979, and who grew up during the 80s and 90s and noughties, they're probably going to have a much more ecumenical attitude to the world. But we might be in for a rocky ride in the next few years.
Your book mentions the oppression and the crackdowns in China, and that includes the Uyghurs. But of the TV series you made, because you went to northwestern China and you met some entrancing, charming people. In fact, you meet wonderful people all over China in that, you know, TV series you made. The New York Times said he invokes the Uyghur minority in Western China several times to make the case for the inclusiveness of various Chinese dynasties. And that's something that you are strong on through history. Without mentioning the recent violent conflict between the Uyghurs and the central government today. And that TV series was made before the crackdown, I think. And your eyes have been opened because you discovered a delightful accommodation of Muslim people in on the, you know, borders of China, as it were, and that's changed.
Well, I mean, I'd say two things about that. I mean, we did film in Xinjiang, and I first went to Xinjiang, you know, 35 years ago, so I have seen the changes, and we did see clear evidence of a crackdown towards Uyghur Muslims when we were filming there for that series, although, of course, we were filming 5 or 6 years ago. You could see that things were tense and that the local security, who hadn't, you know, turned a blind eye towards us for most of our filming, we didn't even have supervision for most of our filming, they got very nervous when we were filming in Xinjiang. And now you see now that this was the beginning of what we're watching. But we filmed. The important thing to understand, I think, is that what we were talking about with the Uyghurs was their incorporation into the Chinese Empire under the Qing dynasty in the 18th century. But the main scenes with Muslims in the TV series were with Muslims who were descended from people who'd been there for 1,000 years or more.
Yeah.
You know, that's in places like Xi'an, you know. And the Muslims in Xi'an, when we filmed at the Great Mosque, I'd filmed actually there so long ago that I knew the father of the guy who was now the manager of the mosque. And he said they'd had a real debate among the council of the mosque as to whether they should have the film crew in to draw attention to them or not. And the progressives among them had said it's a good thing. And he said, but I have to tell you that we are nervous because of the way things are turning now. And it's really important to us that you do make a distinction between us and the Uyghurs, because we're not Uyghurs, you know, we're effectively Han Chinese, you know, our ancestors started coming in the 7th century. And so some of the scenes that you see of the Muslims in the series are from the very deeply rooted communities in China. I mean, there's an incredible sequence in one of these films of women, all women's mosques,
yes,
with women imams leading the prayers, you know. And it's a fantastic scene. And they were wonderful people. It's in a city called Kaifeng, which I've loved for as long as I've been going to China. It's a really great place. I think the New York Times thought I was being too friendly to China, whereas...
Yes, they did.
whereas actually, of course, the films were made with affection for the Chinese people, which is a different matter from the regime. And I felt that affection for the Chinese people and every visit going back 35 years. But even the Muslims who've been there, ancestors were there 1,300 years ago, are feeling nervous at the moment. And that's a very, very sad thing.
One more futurology question. With the Uyghur problem, with the still seething, although they've got an under control Hong Kong problem, with the determination within some of that Communist Party to deal to Taiwan, with, and you make this point in your book, the environmental challenges. Only 11% of the land is arable in China, and a fifth of that is contaminated. And also with the fact that the top 1%, I didn't realise this either, you say this, the top 1% in China own half the wealth there as well. I mean, all this suggests maybe not a terribly long-lived dynasty, that there may be a swifter day of reckoning, even though it all seems rock solid in terms of the rule of the top at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And I think that's what some sinologists and experts on China detect, that there is an uncertainty at the heart there. And that's why I ended the book proper. I mean, there's an epilogue, which I wrote very recently before I went to print. But I ended it with the next cycle of these 516-year conjunctions, that astronomical conjunctions that were deemed to be so important for the rise and fall of dynasties. And the next one is September the 8th, 2040. And of course, I mean, I'm teasing the reader, really. But at the same time, these are metaphors, aren't they? You think, will they last that long? It's by no means as certain as you think, even though they are in a very powerful position at the moment, and he's making sure that that position is all the stronger. But as the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times.
Yes, that's right. I saw that 8th of September 2040 date, which is not that far away now. So now we have, as you put it, a hybrid Confucianist-Leninist state, but without, I think you imply, tell me if I'm wrong, but without a moral core, the sort of moral core necessary for longevity, or is that in the balance?
Yeah. I think history shows you that a government that lacks a moral core, in the end, will lose the allegiance of the people. And China, contrary to what a lot of outsiders might think, has always been a moral civilization where morality is absolutely at the center of this. I'll tell you an interesting story if I've got time. I just made a film about China's greatest poet, Du Fu, who figures in the book. He's an 8th century poet. And he's still taught at school. He's the greatest poet, and everybody knows and loves him. And the film was shown on the BBC, first of all, although it was later shown on CCTV in China. But the BBC version was pirated almost immediately and went all over China. And on the Monday morning after it was shown, friends from Beijing phoned up and said, you're not going to believe this, but the Central Commission for Discipline of the Communist Party, who are the organization that runs the anti-corruption campaign, they're one of the most powerful apparatuses of state, I've got an editorial on their front page about the film. You know, and they were laughing. And I said, what? And they said, yeah. And the editorial is actually about morality. It's about what can we learn from Dufu, who suffered horrendously in war and famine. List one of his children died of starvation. His career collapsed. But he was remembered, is always remembered as the greatest voice, the conscience of the nation, for his kind of moral position and everything. And the editorial by this top commission of the Communist Party said, why is it that our campaign for suppression of corruption has failed? What can we learn from this? And the answer is that our Communist Party cadres have not internalized the moral vision of kindness, virtue, benevolence, fair-mindedness that Dufu stands for. So there you have the leading Communist Party figures looking at a film about an 8th century poet, and they're so serious about their literature there. You know, there's much, much more. They read much more into it than, say, we do in Shakespeare or something. It's much more central to the culture and the vision of what they stand for. You know, I thought that was an interesting thing, you know, that they'd immediately seen a much bigger picture in this little film, you know.
Yeah, well done. You see, you concentrate on the main dynasties, and there's so much detail in your family stories. You tell the tale of China to a great extent through the eyes of individuals, and it's a lovely technique. But on the other hand, as with Dufu, there are lots of often noble individuals saddened and thwarted and endangered by the times that they lived in. It's been turbulent right through. So why should we subscribe, I guess, to the idea of a placid China now when its history is so roiling and always has been?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We think of China, don't we, as a kind of immemorially stable, one dynasty rolling sedately after another. But it wasn't like that at all. I mean, the stories are just unbelievable. I mean, you could almost say, you know, look at Western Europe with Napoleonic Wars and the Hundred Years' War, and there's been just the same there, absolutely brutal, incredible things during which the ordinary people, as well as the writers and the thinkers and men and women, have tried to live their lives with virtue and keep sustaining the idea that a just order is possible on this earth, you know. And we're all trying to do that still today, aren't we? That's the moving thing about it. You know, no, there's no guarantee. You know, China's 20th century history is absolutely unbelievable in its the violence, you know, the communist uprisings, the Long March, the Japanese invasion, the Civil War, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution. I mean, the Great Leap Forward, something like 36 million people died of starvation in the Great Famine from 59 to 61. You know, people are still living who went through all that. So the turbulence of it is incredible. And there's a great fear at the heart of governance in China that we cannot go back to anything like that. I remember talking to a friend's mum about it, who I saw when I was filming the film about the Chinese poet. She's an ordinary mum in a small town, and we were saying, you know, God, it's amazing, isn't it? She said, yeah, we lived through the Great Famine and the Cultural Revolution, and now, you know, look at my clothes, and we've got a Starbucks in town, you know, and even in provincial China, we're well fed. We're not starving like we were then. You can see why giving our allegiance to a state that gives us stability and order makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think we intuit that even from a great distance, as you say, we can see the appeal of that. I just want to ask you one more thing in the time we've got. You say, though, despite all this and the turbulence, the greatest civilization on earth is rising again. Can you just tell us what makes it the greatest civilization on earth?
I think just the richness of the culture over so many thousands of years, the beauty of the art and the beauty of the poetry. I mean, I'm bigging it a bit for the book, aren't I? You know, you'd probably say Western music is greater and Western drama, but But in terms of the widest range of its achievements through the sciences and astronomy and poetry and painting and philosophy and thought and history, its achievements over so many centuries are truly staggering.
Just quickly before we go, don't tell me women are not the stuff of heroes. That's a quote on your book, yeah. And the women poets and thinkers feature prominently in the beginnings of feminism in China, coincided with its appearance in the West pretty much. When we look at China analytical, we sometimes neglect, I'm sure, the progress that they've made there on women's rights, individual rights, employees' rights. There's been a lot of specific freedom granted to people in China, hasn't there?
Yes, and women, the achievements with women's rights have been really great. You know, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, think about the suffragettes in Britain. And actually, the great feminist manifesto of Her Jun was written in 1907. Yeah. And it's an amazingly radical piece of women's liberation. And we don't, this is one of the things I'm trying to bang on about, I suppose, really. You think of China in certain ways, you know, the empire and the emperors and so on. But what we don't know in the West is the incredible variety of thought and reflection and creativity and humanity in it, you know. And the women's story is one which I'm glad you picked up on that, because I was really keen that the book unfolded where you hear the voice of women. And some of the women's voices in the book are really great, I think.
Great to talk with you. Congratulations on the book, and thank you very much for giving us your time too.
Thanks a lot. Great pleasure. I hope to see you in person one day.
On a book tour. Professor Michael Wood. Yep. Professor Michael Wood.